It's always good to have Eric back with us. He is sent on missions to Austin every few months from California. And I can imagine him telling his family, "Well, I'm off to Austin to worship at Day Spring and study Job." It's been going on a long time now. And tonight we are in chapter 40. Job chapter 40, and there is a break here in the speeches of the Lord. He comes to the end of his tour through creation, where he has spoken about the stars and the seas and the various animals, including one as brainless as the ostrich and one as powerful as the horse. And he's talked about the eagles and even the vultures. And he essentially ends this first speech as we go into chapter 40 in verses 1 and 2. "And the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Answer what? What has God been demonstrating about himself in these vignettes about the aspects of nature and the animal kingdom?
Sovereign over all.
He's sovereign over all. He is the creator and the one who is in control over everything from the clouds and the snow and the rain to the lions and the mountain goats. And he is asking if Job can answer this. And he calls Job a fault finder. He says, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty?" Because, of course, this is where Job, as a blameless and perfect man, showed himself to be blameworthy and imperfect in attributing wrong things to God, counting God as his enemy, and essentially saying, as God will make the point of answering, that he could have perhaps dispensed justice a little better than God, because he feels like that there has been injustice done to him. Remember, Job is the one who, the last time he spoke, said that he had this, he imagined, rather, having the indictment of his adversary. And he was saying that he would boldly come into God's courtroom. He said, "Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." I don't imagine anybody would say that after the display that God has just given to Job. "Like a prince, I would approach him." And God is asking Job here, "Can you answer all these things that I have shown you? Do you dare to contend with the Almighty?" Job answers the Lord, and it's an interesting answer. I want us to consider it very carefully. He says, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." He's probably not talking so much about times one and times two that he's spoken, as he simply is saying that he's spoken once and again. This is kind of a Hebraism that you see in books of prophecy. like God telling Amos, for three transgressions and for four, I will not turn back the punishment. Well, he says, I've spoken once and again. I have spoken, in other words, several times, but I will proceed no further. Now, what's interesting is that this doesn't end God's speeches to Job. This only provokes another one. And furthermore, there's something significantly missing from Job's reply. You and I might have added this at this point, but Job doesn't add it till later. What is missing in Job's reply here that has to be elicited from him later on? Repentance. Later on, he will repent. But right now, he's just overwhelmed. His mouth is shut. He realizes basically one thing. What is it? I am of small account. I am virtually nothing compared to you. And he does say, I lay my hand on my mouth. I'm not going to talk anymore. He's chastened enough to shut up, which is a good position for some of us to be in sometimes. But yet he still hasn't quite gotten to repentance. Have you ever dealt with anybody like that? Have you ever dealt with anybody who went ahead and acknowledged the situation as it was, but couldn't quite go on yet to say, well, I'm sorry. I was culpable. I had a responsibility in this situation. What happens so often when you share the gospel with people? We could ask Dave, if he's been having this firsthand as he knocks on doors around the neighborhood. What about the people who say, yes, I believe in Jesus. Yes, I believe the Bible. Does that mean that they then go on to repent and receive Him as Lord? No. It does.
They go, bye.
Yeah, they just say bye. Yeah, they say, sure, I believe. You bet I believe. Yes. Now, leave me alone. You know. Have you ever known of somebody who had a great deal of trouble saying that he or she was sorry? Just almost couldn't do it. But maybe that applies to some of you. And you at least, you know, acknowledge the gravity of the situation, but it's very, very hard to swallow pride and say, well, I got it wrong, or I'm sorry, or please forgive me. In other words, Job's response is good so far, and there's nothing to find fault with what he says. He should be putting his hand on his mouth. He should be considering himself of small account, but he has not gotten to the place where he actually repents. And that's why the book doesn't stop here. That's why God goes on to say more to him, because that could be a question that seems to raise itself here. If you read verses 4 and 5, they sound like a very good, humble answer. Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. One could almost think, hey, this is where the book ought to end. Job has been subdued into silence. And that's what we want, isn't it? Well, not quite. Not quite. There's still more for God to reveal about himself. So,
this has been one of the things that has puzzled me about this book all these years. Is, you know, God is approaching Job, it seems like to me, really carefully and slowly.
Yes.
Gently. And I dare say that most of us wouldn't have come as far as Job has at this point. Do you understand what I'm saying? If God wanted to really, you know, present himself as God, Job would have been on his face, on the ground, right then.
Sure, it happened to Isaiah.
It happened to Isaiah.
And it happened to Peter when he saw the omniscience of Jesus and knowing where to cast the net.
Yeah, that's right.
You know.
And I don't think it's a fault of Job's. I think it's God's approach.
Yeah, it is. But one of the things to remember, too, that distinguishes Job from Isaiah or Peter is that Job had endured all of this inexplicable suffering. This inexplicable suffering is what keeps Job holding back from the kind of surrender that he will exhibit after chapter 41. He has no clue as to why he has endured the loss of his family and property and his health. And because of the sheer painfulness of what Job has gone through, there's still, I think, a reticence on his part to completely give up. He's not there yet. And I think God is going to now take the measures to bring him to the place where he really needs to be. So, Job is essentially saying that frustrating thing that has probably been said to you when you've confronted someone or when you have tried to counsel someone or witness to someone. Have you ever had somebody simply throw up their hands and say, "What can I say?" Ever had that? "What can I say?" And you want to tell them, well, you might say A, B, C, D, E, and F, and a few other things I can think of. But they just stop and say, "Well, what can I say? You've overwhelmed me. There's no further answer." And I think Job is to that place right now, but that's still not quite where he needs to be. Yes, Dan?
I think he's closer than you think. Well, maybe, because he knows about when they sat around the gates, the elders did, when he even said when young men would walk by or something, they put their hands over their mouths. So he's showing that he's very lower than God.
Oh, yes.
This wisdom is much higher than his.
Yeah.
And he's going to put his hand over his mouth. I mean, he's not going to respond.
Yeah.
Right, you know, to answer in time.
That's right. He's
sit there and listen.
This is definitely, you know, the first step in his chastening. And I think Ben's point is well taken that God is approaching him God is actually approaching him in many ways as Job thought he wanted. Now, God's too merciful to just lay it on Job like he really imagined. But Job has really wanted to approach God as an equal. He's wanted to approach him, you know, as one who would contend with him. And and this is kind of illustrated in the sixth verse, that God is permitting this about as much as he can. God, you know, will only go so far. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, dress for action like a man. Well, this term man here is not the usual Hebrew word for man. The usual Hebrew word for man is Adam, Adam. So there are some places in the first few chapters of Genesis where you're not real sure whether the word Adam should be translated as Adam or man. But that's exactly how you can translate, then the Lord put the man in the Garden of Eden. He put Adam in the Garden of Eden. This isn't that word. This is Geber. And Geber is an interesting word because it means one who is fulfilling his potential as a man. It was the word used for warriors. And what God is saying is very similar to what we might say to someone when we want that person to behave to their fullest capacity as a human being. If you say to a man, be a man, what are you saying? Because the man is already a man. He is of the male gender. What do you mean when you say be a man?
Have a backbone.
Have a backbone, yes. Have a backbone, or take your chastening, take your medicine, or go through this situation, endure it. And that is what God is saying to Job. Dress for action like a Geber. G-E-B-E-R is the transliteration of it. Dress for action. Gird up your loins is the old King James Version. He is saying, be a man in the sense that you will hear what I say, heed what I say, and obey what I say. You can take it, now do it. That's the idea. I will question you, and you make it known to me. And here is an extremely embarrassing question for Job, and it hits right dead home to most of us. Verse 8. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? In other words, we are tempted, even as Christians, to wonder about the wisdom of God and whether or not He is right in this situation or that situation. But whatever my God ordains is right. And that is God's point to Job. And certainly you've cringed in horror as you have listened to unbelievers rant about how if they were God, they would do this, or God failed to do some situation that they thought that He should have. And their notion is that, yes, God's in the wrong. You bet He's in the wrong, that their knowledge of right and wrong is greater than God's. And brothers and sisters, God defines right and wrong. It is from God that we get all conception whatsoever of right and wrong and good and evil. What we have in our conscience that tells us this is right and that is wrong, even before we know any written law, comes from God, from our being made in the image of God. And yet there are people who are so impetuous that they will put God in the wrong. And they will condemn Him. And the motivation is very, very subtle and very, very sinister. What did Satan promise to Eve if only she would eat of the forbidden fruit? She would be like God. She would be like God. You shall be as God, knowing good and evil. As a matter of fact, the temptation was a little more than that, wasn't it? Because Satan had already insinuated the idea that God was giving them a raw deal in the Garden of Eden. He wasn't giving them as much of a blessing as he could have. He said, has he really commanded that you should not eat of any tree of the Garden of Eden? And she said, well, we can eat of a tree. It's just not that one, not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it was the question, has God said? Has God really said this? And the idea was to doubt his veracity and to doubt his justice and to doubt him. And so the temptation had this element in it at the very beginning. Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? God help us if we are people who are so concerned to be right that we not only cannot ever admit that we're wrong to anyone else, but we actually think that we are holier than God. We actually think that we are in the right in a situation, and if God does something different from what we would do, then it is us who's wrong. Now, of course, none of us would state this quite so boldly, but we have all encountered this argument in unbelievers and some professing Christians, and we have seen the dark shadow of this thought in our own lives, that somehow we know better than God and know more than God, and the important thing is to be in the right. One of the interesting things is to analyze the motives of people. Underneath it all, regardless of what they profess and what they claim, it's fascinating to see what really is important to them, what drives them. I was reading an interesting article this week. There is a famous feminist author named Naomi Wolf, and she's appeared a lot on television embracing the feminist cause, has written a lot of best-selling books. She's quite well-known. And so recently she's revealed that one of her professors, a very famous professor at Yale named Harold Bloom, made a pass at her when she was in college. And she says that she's just never gotten over this and it scarred her for life, and after all these years she just had to get it out and so on. And I read an article critiquing her by, thank God, a woman. And this woman said, consider Naomi Wolf. She is rich, she is influential, she has had bestsellers, she is famous, she has every mark of success that she as a feminist would have wanted, but none of them are equal to her main goal in life of being a victim. Her main goal in life, victimization, is what is important to Naomi Wolf. And do you know, I've known some actual flesh and blood people like that who wanted to be a victim, who wanted pity for people to feel sorry for them more than they wanted anything else in the world. And there are some people who want to be right and be unquestioned and be in control more than they want anything else in the world. And it doesn't wash with God. There's a place where that butts up against the righteousness of God. He says, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God? And the arm, of course, stands for power. And can you thunder with a voice like his? Now, we're about to come to a section that is enormously important, because what Job has seen is evidence of God's control and his creatorship over everything, and his control and providence over animals and the elements. And this has at least caused him to put his hand over his mouth. So God is sovereign over the created order. But there's one more thing that Job needs to know, and that is that God is sovereign over the moral order. Because remember, he's convinced Job that he's God. He may not yet have convinced him that he is just. So we can all bow before God. He's bigger than us. He can hurt us. But to actually be able to say, my God is right, my God is just, the judge of all the earth will do right, and even to say one further thing, that his purposes toward his people are always good, that is a great challenge. And frankly, many Christians embrace that only after they come to the Reformed faith. It's becoming more aware of the sovereignty of God that causes many Christians to be able to embrace that God works all things together for the good of those who love Him, who are called according to His purpose. But it is that idea that we're now entering to in the book of Job, and it's really that idea that is the reason for God's bringing up the last two beasts that He brings up. Behemoth and Leviathan. So we're going to look at verses 10 through 14. I still believe, of course, that even though God is very firm with Job, that He is not sneering and jeering at him in His tone. I agree with Ben that he's holding back, but he is making Job see the irony of the situation. And so what he does is invite Job to put himself in God's place and adorn himself with the very characteristics of God. You remember that some of these words are shot through the Psalms. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, You're very great. You're clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with white as with a garment. Psalm 104, for example. Well, this is what God says to Job. Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. Let's think about what he's saying here. You may remember when you first learned to drive a car. Perhaps it was simply an instructor, a driver's education course that taught you, or perhaps it was a brave parent who taught you how to drive a car. But do you remember the feeling that you had when you had watched the parent for all of those years? You basically knew what all of the functions of the car were, and yet the parent put you in the driver's seat for the first time and said, all right, you take over. Well, that was hard enough, wasn't it? But imagine if you were invited, as so often happens in the movies, for somebody to take over the cockpit of a jumbo jet when they don't know anything about what they're doing. Well, when Job is asked by God, okay, clothe yourself with my power, my splendor, my majesty, and you be the one in charge of passing judgment. You be the one in charge of judging all the earth. Can you do it? And that's an interesting question, isn't it? Why is that an interesting question? What have Job's comforters been trying to do all through this book? Well, they've been trying to mimic God. They've been trying to explain God to Job and to treat Job like they think God would treat him, and to say to Job what they think God would want them to say. I really believe that in spite of the fault we've found with the counselors, that most of them would, you know, be qualified to be deacons at a Southern Baptist church. You know, they're not mean. They may just be mean-spirited. That's never prevented people from being deacons in a Southern Baptist church. Okay? What was the problem with Job's counselors? They didn't know enough. They didn't know enough. And what they had, the idea that they had in their mind was simply sin and retribution, obedience and rewards. And that's all they could think of. They could not get out of that paradigm. Well, God, of course, sees extremely complex situations. Have any of you actually had to serve on a jury before? Eric has, okay? And Smokey has. And Brian, the rest of you have been able to get out of it. Okay. All right. Was it easy?
No.
No. Why wasn't it?
It was a lot of responsibility.
Yeah?
And to know who was telling the truth and who wasn't.
To know who was telling the truth and who wasn't. And furthermore, if the case is even this much complicated, it requires the wisdom of Solomon to be able to decide, well, who really was in the wrong and who should suffer the punishment and how much punishment should they suffer?
And the people with that wisdom got out of the jury duty.
Yeah, the people with that wisdom got out of jury duty. Okay. Here is the challenge. Most of us are pretty good at thinking evil people should be punished. Bad situations should be dealt with decisively. We're pretty good at thinking in black and white. But what we cannot do is think in the same kinds of terms as God. Let me show you what I mean. Turn over to Genesis chapter 50. Genesis 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sins because they did evil to you." I don't know about y'all, but since there is no cross-reference for that command, I think they were lying through their teeth. I don't think that Jacob gave that command before he died for them to say that to Joseph. I think that they concocted that in order to try to get Joseph's favor. And said, "And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones." Then he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. That doesn't fit the paradigm, does it? Doesn't fit the paradigm of crime and punishment, obedience and rewards. And the reason it doesn't fit the paradigm is because of love and grace. First of all, Joseph's love and grace. But even beyond that is the love and grace of God. The love and grace of God toward the brothers, who he blessed in spite of their evil, But then also there's the providence of God in ordering that crime against Joseph so that it was part of his plan to save the nation of Israel and to get them to Egypt, whereby he would further fulfill his plan by bringing them out one day by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. You see, all of this is too complicated for you and me. And it's too complicated for Job. There is a sovereign plan of God that has to be taken into consideration when God administers justice. So, I think there's a real good comment here by Francis Anderson in commenting on these passages. Occasionally, most of the time Anderson is very, very terse in his commentary, but then occasionally he'll stop a minute and give you some extremely valuable reflections. And he says here, he brings Job to the end of his quest by convincing him that he may and must hand the whole matter over completely to God, more trustingly, less fretfully, and do it without insisting that God should first answer all his questions and give him a formal acquittal. Here is a very great depth, if we have rightly found the heart of the theology of the whole book. There is a rebuke in it for any person who, by complaining about particular events in his life, implies that he could propose to God better ways of running the universe than those God currently uses. Men are eager to use force to combat evil, and in their impatience, they wish God would do the same more often. But by such destructive acts, men do and become evil. To behave as God suggests here, Job would not only usurp the role of God, he would become another Satan. Only God can destroy creatively. Isn't that an interesting sentence? Only God can destroy creatively. You've had that happen in your life, haven't you? He's destroyed your past. That's true of every single one of you. But has he ever destroyed a particular hope or ambition that you had in order to put you on the right track for what he wanted you to do? Aren't you glad that there are some jobs you didn't get? There are some vocations that you weren't allowed to pursue? Furthermore, if God were to have immediately punished everyone who ever did you harm, done what you wanted and probably struck them dead at your feet, if he had done that, he would have short-circuited a process that needed to go on in you so that you learned to love your enemies and bless those who cursed you and pray for those who despitefully used you and persecuted you. We often think we wish God would act so decisively, and yet he is doing something bigger, and only God can destroy creatively. I am so glad. Some of you know this about me, but many years ago, before Willie Nelson grew long hair and became an outlaw, he was a short-haired, turtleneck-wearing singer-songwriter from Nashville. And in 1968, he discovered me and liked my songs and signed me to a songwriting contract with his music publishing company in Nashville and promised to record some of my songs. How about that? He doesn't even, I'm sure that if I could even get past the goons that guard him, he would not even remember me to this day. Thank God that the Lord Jesus Christ kept me out of the dirty music business and called me to preach his gospel instead. He destroyed creatively my creativity. Okay. So Anderson's comment here is, only God can transmute evil into good. which is what we've seen in the Joseph story, but we see it supremely in the Lord Jesus Christ. The worst evil ever performed has brought the greatest blessing to the world. Please the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. Why? So that he could save a multitude that no man can number. So Anderson continues, as creator, responsible for all that happens in his world, he's able to make everything, good and bad, work together into good. The debate has been elevated to a different level. The reality of God's goodness lies beyond justice. We think we want justice, don't we? Or I don't. What I want is for God's justice to have fallen on Jesus instead of me. I want God's grace. The reality of God's goodness lies beyond justice. That's why the categories of guilt and punishment, true and terrible though they are, can only view human suffering as a consequence of sin, not as an occasion of grace. What did the disciples say to Jesus about that blind man? They thought they were being so theologically smart. They gave Jesus two theological options. They said, who sinned, this man or his parents? They acknowledged that it might be the parents' fault. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They knew that this blindness must be a punishment, and they were at least willing to allow that it might not be the man himself, maybe his mom and dad. And Jesus said, neither he nor his parents sinned. He said, but that the works of God should be manifest in him. The works of God should be manifest in him. And this is what people whose view of God is so narrow that all they can see is crimes and the punishments fail to understand. There is a goodness of God that transcends what goes on in the world and uses what goes on in the world for His glory and works everything for the good of those who love Him, who are called according to His purpose. So Job can't do what God is asking him to do. He can't execute judgment on the wicked in any fair and just way. He can't be responsible to pour out anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. And he says, if you can do all that, then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. Job has learned that any deliverance, any vindication, any approval that matters comes from God. And that's true of us. Our own right hand can't save us. We learn that in most every situation we engage in. We're utterly dependent on God. Well, now you know the background for talking about Behemoth. Because what is being said here is that God is not only the God of the created order, but He is the God of the moral order as well. And so at the end here of his second speech to Job, he brings out the first of his two biggest beasts. And he says, behold, Behemoth, which I made as I made you. I have created both you and this beast. He eats grass like an ox. Behold his strength in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like bars of iron. He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brook surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he is not frightened. He's confident though Jordan rushes against his mouth. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? Well, needless to say, this beast is not specified. So scholars have wondered what it is. Behemoth is actually just the Hebrew word for beast. As a matter of fact, it's even a plural word. But this is obviously singular, so it's kind of like the Lord is saying to Job, behold the beast, or behold the beast of beasts. Anybody have any comments about Behemoth? it could be certainly some sort of ancestor of a beast that we now know, and I think probably Leviathan stands a better chance of that.
Well, just that it tails like a cedar.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Cedars of Lebanon are huge.
Yeah. And that is the problem with it being a hippopotamus.
And the way it's put forward is more than what we know. But I just happened to look on the internet today, and this is dated Tuesday, March 2nd, and it's for the National Academy of Sciences.
Yeah.
And these paleontologists and these people have been working on the impact crater, you know, the asteroid is supposed to have killed off all the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always had a big problem because they kept finding dinosaur bones in areas where they shouldn't be, and so they would always push up the boundaries more, even though they radiometric dated it. And so this girl has looked it over so well, but just to show you that dinosaurs could have came off the ark and lived, not in great numbers, but in small numbers, because they're fine on that. But she says it's challenging such a perfect story of the asteroid strike has made her unpopular at times, vilified by those who support the massive wipeout theory. Paleontologist Mike Norrell said the feud among scientists about what exactly led to the demise of the dinosaurs can be tested at times. And he goes on to say, it's really interesting is that this guy, he's an evolutionist, and he says, and speaking as a dinosaur paleontologist, Norrell said that not all the dinosaurs became extinct 65 million years ago. Then he has to make a joke. We just call them birds now. So what he's saying is that all the pressure is on them now to answer this. And they've already radiometric dated things. And if this lady is right, they're going to have to throw out some things.
Yeah.
And it just shows you that in slower numbers after the flood, they still could possibly be there. And one other thing is that in to show you how recent dinosaurs could be is that in Brazil, now this is from the just recently in January 16th of 2004, and this is going to be published in one of the big journals, is that they found dinosaur bones in the Amazon rainforest. And this is really hard on them because they can't say it's a volcano that covered them, or a rushing river that covered them, or a sandstorm that did it, or anything like that, because they found them with the fauna and flora of the rainforest.
Yeah.
And what happens is that they decay so quickly. They said that even the, it says here, it says the find confounded the view of many scientists that paleontology research in the Amazon rainforest was fruitless because of the high humidity, which they believed would have caused relatively rapid decay of fossils. Just not tossing out too quick.
Yeah, that's right. And the point is that the hippopotamus has been classically the guess of the commentators, and yet there are some un-hippopotamus-like things about the creature that is described here, because of the fact that he's a creature who does have some sort of incredible tail, which a hippo does not, and he is a creature of both the marsh and the mountains. The mountains yield food for him. So what we have to look at here is what this beast is symbolic of. It's a beast that Job would have known. It's a beast that Job would have understood. And it comes after this section about how if Job could somehow take on the role of God, then God would acknowledge to him that his own right hand could save him. What I think is being said here is that this great beast, whatever he was, is introduced to show that the moral God who always does what is right and whose goodness is above all other considerations is in charge of every beast, even the most fearsome, even the most bizarre. And for me personally, that means that God's in charge of your beast, whatever it is that you're going through, whatever situation you have to face, because this behemoth is only controlled by him who made him. Verse 19 says, he's the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. In other words, no mere mortal is going to come against this thing with a sword. But God can, with his sword. And I think that that is the reason for the illustration at this point. God has convinced Job that he is powerful. What I think he's doing here in the last two chapters is convincing Job that he may trust him to be just, because he is in charge of the greatest and most fearsome beast there is. I think the message to Job would have been, God has been in charge of every death that you've suffered and every pain from every boil that you have scraped with the potsherd and every accusation of even your friendly enemies. He has been in charge. And one of the things that for all of us to be challenged with is simply to ask ourselves, in every situation, what is God doing here? Usually we can figure out what Satan's doing. We think, well, he's setting me up. He's trying to get me to do this. He's dispiriting me. He's discouraging me. I know what the enemy's up to. The question is, what is God trying to get you to do? So whatever beast you have, whatever beastly situation you will face, God is the one who can come at it with his sword. He's the one who can take it by its eyes. He's the one who can pierce its nose with a snare. This is a confident beast. Confident though the Jordan rushes against his mouth. He doesn't get out of the river when the floods are raging. But God is sovereign over this beast. And I think that's the lesson of Job 4a. All right, we will go on to Leviathan next week. And tonight we want to pray about a number of things here that I have before me. First of all,